Welcome back to the Balance is Bullshit podcast, the real stories of blending motherhood and career, where we're sitting down with mamas and caregivers that are making waves in their career. And we get the unvarnished version of what it's like, their trade-offs, the epiphanies, the milestones. Whether you're here because it's a tough day, you're celebrating, or you want to get tools to craft your most fulfilled life, we've got you. And remember, you're welcome here as your whole self, not just your best self. Let's get to today's episode.
Hey, it's Jess. Here's the deal. I'm excited to share every conversation with you all. Like, that's the point, right? If I don't feel inspired or seen or don't think there's value in a conversation, why would I share it? I haven't felt that way yet at all. Quite the opposite, actually. But let me tell you, this one, do not sleep on this episode. Do not end it early. If you have to end it early, come back to it. Deborah is a gift. This conversation made me feel seen, hopeful. It reinforced how critical it is to show up authentically for my vision, for your vision, to say it out loud, unapologetically. It was also a stark reminder that the right decision in work and in life can make someone else feel pretty uncomfortable. But we need not shy away from those moments. We need to get confident in making others uncomfortable, not only for ourselves, but also as an example for the bossy girls that we are so proudly raising, and we get to talk about all of that. I will tell you that in the episode today, we do cover sexual assault, Deborah's experience with that, what she's learned from it and taken from it, and frankly, how a lot of the learnings she's taken from it also applies to who she is as a leader, as a boss lady. And I need you to know that, because if this triggers something in you that puts your mental health or physical health this very moment in not such a good place, don't worry. Come back. See us next time, and we will be here for you. If you can come, and this will actually hearing her experience will help you and empower you and make you feel less alone, I hope you stay. We cover a lot. It is, it does come up around minute 21. So if you wanted to skip around it, you can also try to do that. But I'm really, really grateful for Deborah. One of the other concepts and takeaways for me is this concept that she knew in her gut she was ready to be a CEO a few years back, but she kept telling herself lies in her head that we all do so frequently. Things like, my resume is not quite ready for that yet. And letting those voices keep her from claiming her path out loud and unapologetically. And one of the pieces of advice that she shares from her lived experience that she needed herself just a few years back was, don't wait for confidence or comfort to feel capable. How often do you wait to feel confident or comfortable in your current surroundings to say, oh yeah, I've got this. I'm totally capable of going after that thing or saying this thing. It's amazing. There's so much depth to this concept, and we cover it from a number of different angles, so you'll have to hear about it yourself. I'm sorry. I'm sick. I've been sick. My kids live in a petri dish during the day, and they come back and they give it to me, and I'm struggling, but I am so energized to bring you this that I am pushing through to record this intro and get it into your hands, because it cannot wait. So I'm going to keep this one short. I will end letting you know that our guest today is Deborah Senra, and I am so thrilled for you to hear this conversation. Deborah lives in Chicago today with her partner and her two girls. She is now the CEO of a generative AI company that's in stealth mode, that if you are in enterprise software, professional services space, you will no doubt want to hear about. She comes from a background in revenue leadership and consulting and has so much experience to offer us today. I cannot wait to hear what you think and what you've taken away, because my takeaways are plentiful. Enjoy the conversation and can't wait to see you again soon.
Welcome, Deborah. Thanks for joining. We're what, midway through the week, recording on a Wednesday. I feel like that day is usually, it can be a good day. It can be a transition day. It can be an, oh no, I need more time this week. Like, what's today for you?
You know, as a founder, CEO of a seed stage startup, every day is crazy. There's no middle of the week in this phase of my career. So it's a great day. Yes.
Okay, good. A great day is not, can't always say that. So
yeah,
take that as a positive. And you're based in Chicago, right?
Yes, just north of Chicago in Evanston.
Nice. What brought you, have you born and raised in the area, or what brought you to Chicago?
No, I was born in San Francisco, raised in Minnesota, nice. And then hopped all around. And early in my career, I was working out of Washington, D.C., and they wanted to open an office in Chicago. And I raised my hand to go do that and run the account management function out of the Chicago office. And so that's what brought me here. And then I convinced my sister and her husband to move here, my parents to move here. And then I met my husband, who's an elementary school teacher. So we're pretty much locked.
I mean, it's amazing to be locked when you have that, sounds like you've built quite the community there, and not built, but like almost transplanted and built, it sounds like.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I don't know how people do it. Mad props to people that move away from their family. They have, especially if they have kids. I don't know how you do it. I've never paid for a babysitter. We have so many family members in the area that's just an endless network of people that can help. And our kids are definitely community raised.
that's pretty epic. I grew up in New Jersey, and my husband and I moved out here after living in Boston for a bit. And I remember saying, when we made the decision to move out here out in the East Bay of San Francisco now, saying to him, we can get on that plane, but we are 5-year max. We are not buying a house there. We are not having kids there. Like, we need to go back to the East Coast. And, you know, fast forward 14 years later, and we're married, house in the suburbs, 2 kids. His family has transplanted here as well. My family, you know, makes it out, and vice versa, as much as possible. But I don't know. You know, I do have a decent amount of friends that don't have any family in the area, and we're really lucky that my in-laws are here and we have family. It's wild, and it's expensive when you have to manage it all. I mean, even with us, we still have to have daycare, like with having in-laws, we still have to have daycare and a nanny part-time. And it's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. We're luckily out of the daycare years. Our girls went to daycare 3 days a week, and then grandma and abuelo took them 2 days a week. And we still, when the last one left daycare, the amount we were spending on daycare is what we now pay in mortgage for our lake house. And we went to the cheapest daycare we could find. This is not a bougie situation. This is like, they lost a kid 6 months ago, and so their prices dropped. And it's still a mortgage. So I don't, it's, something's got to change in that area. It's insane.
It's insane. I mean, I remember, you know, getting to the point where we needed to send our kids, because we both had full-time out of the home jobs. And I understood for the first time truly on paper why one parent or one, you know, caregiver decides not to work, because the cost is insane.
Yeah.
That's wonderful that you have parents. That you have family, so much family in the area. How old are your kids now?
They're about to turn 11 and 9. So, but emotionally they're both 16.
Yeah. Okay. Always emotionally ahead of their time, or is that a more recent?
No, I would say the younger one follows the older one. And so when the younger one started hitting puberty and getting all the emotions, the younger one mimics it. So they're running around in crop tops and talking about Meghan Trainor concerts and we're along for the ride at this point.
Yeah, you're like, and now it's your life and we're just living in it.
Exactly.
I guess probably a sneak peek into my world. Actually, you, this is a perfect, it's, we're talking about your girls. I am also a proud mom of bossy girls. I yeah. love that on your LinkedIn. Where, like, what made you put that there? Give us the scoop. What's the background?
Well, I think there's probably during the pandemic, they were very present. One was in kindergarten. The other was in second grade when the pandemic started. And something, if you didn't have a kindergartner at the start of COVID, what you don't realize is that they can't read. And so when they get on a Zoom call and the teacher says, all right, everybody hit end Zoom, they can't read. So they can't find it. So there was this moment where I had my computer and I was running an all hands with like 250 people. And then I hear my daughter's teacher saying, get your mom to help you get off the Zoom, which is like, I mean, I could go for days about why it was mom. And I just lost it on both calls. And so they became very integrated into my work as a result. But then transparently, it's hard to make really bold decisions in your career. And oftentimes when I'm faced with those decisions that scare me, I think of them and I think of the model I want to be for them. And I want to raise bossy girls, being a boss. That's what it's all about. If they want that, and whether that's professionally or just being the boss of their own lives, I'm trying to take that word back as a positive for them.
I love that. Because I think about how when people ask me, you know, what are they like? What are your daughters like? I mean, my kids are both so different. They're just such unique personalities, both so bright, such bright lights. My youngest is, I always say she's so bold. She's like, she is just, and yes, that can be very challenging, but I also am like, I don't want to put out her light because that is the light that is going, that boldness, that, you know, confidence is the thing that's going to propel her in her career, in her life, in her relationships. Like, I know it's going to be great. And yeah. It's sometimes freaking hard.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I love taking back the word boss. That's bossy. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, I had to unlearn a lot of things just in life. The idea that it's my job to make sure everybody around me is comfortable, even though I'm not. And that has actually, there's a part of that that has served me really well, especially professionally. But there's a part of my life and some of the worst experiences of my life were because I put myself at risk. At the risk of making somebody else uncomfortable. And so the world is going to teach them those lessons. I don't want it to come from me. I think the more I can teach them to say what they want clearly, I told my 11-year-old, we had a tough conversation this week because she had sent an email to a friend saying that she was mad at her. And we had a hard conversation that those aren't the conversations you put in emails. Those are conversations that you have face to face. And you say it from your chest, what you're going to say. You look the person in the eye and you do it with kindness, but you don't hide behind a computer screen to have hard conversations. Never. And those are the lessons. That to me is what a boss is. Not telling people which toys to play with and needing to be in charge all the time, but being a true bossy woman, which is, you know, you have the hard conversations face to face. You say what you need. That's what bossy means.
Owning the hard, owning the good, bad, and ugly.
And not pretending that you're okay with somebody else's ideas or vision because you don't want to be seen as opinionated or bossy. That's a good thing to have vision. It's a good thing to want to take charge. It's a good thing to have direction. It's a good thing to disagree, especially if you learn the ability to disagree and commit. Layers upon layers about why I love my bossy girls, but
so many. I love it. Where I feel like I'm gonna pull on a thread that you mentioned there because I think I'm gonna pull on a thread because one, it really resonates, and I don't think it will only resonate with me. You said it, you learned the hard, you know, you kind of learned the hard way about making, you know, realizing that it's not your job to make others feel comfortable. And while it has served you in your career, which I can absolutely relate to, it has also put yourself probably in the back burner in situations that you're not comfortable with. I'm curious if you could kind of bring that to life. Are there any examples that stand out in your mind that where that was happening, or a moment where you realize that like, this no longer serves me and I need to change, and kind of how that came to life?
Yeah. I mean, trigger warning for anybody listening, but it came over a prolonged period of time after multiple sexual assaults, and it happened outside the workplace, and it also happened in the workplace. And it was situations where you're with a client or with a colleague, and you can feel that they are entering a territory that is not safe. But the last thing you want to do is make them uncomfortable by calling out. You can't put your hand, like, get your hand off my knee. Don't put your hand on my butt. Don't touch me there. And so you laugh, or you try to divert it without making them uncomfortable. And there are a handful of times where I was not successful. And then there was if I'm honest, it was not a reflection in the moment saying you need to put your comfort before theirs. It was, you know, transparently, the first time it happened, I was 13, and I didn't tell anybody about it until I was 33. And at which point it had happened multiple times after that. There's a prolonged period of shame that you have to get through, that I must have done something to give a signal that I wanted that. And so it's taken a lot of growth and work to realize that I didn't do anything to deserve it. And I'm not blaming myself for not screaming no and kicking them in the nuts. But I don't want my the root of it was I should have said, what the hell are you doing? This is so inappropriate. And I want my daughters to never have to go through that journey of learning that. Yeah. I actually was at a wedding a year ago where a girlfriend of mine, there was a drunk groomsman, and the photographer was walking around taking pictures, and he leaned over and slapped her behind. And I saw it. And my initial reaction was like, I felt very awkward. I didn't want to ruin the wedding, but my girlfriend shot up out of her seat, went around the table, grabbed the guy's hands and said, don't you ever touch a woman like that again. She is working. She is not yours to touch. And then she turned to the other groomsman and she goes, get him in line or I'm getting him out. This is not okay. And I just burst into tears at the table because I thought that was not my first instinct, but that is absolutely the right first instinct. Oh. So I'm still learning to do it myself, but anything I can teach my daughters to do to avoid this journey that I'm on, that's what I'm going to do.
I'm sorry that happened to you time and time again. And I am also, I'm also really grateful that you're willing to share, because I think you sharing allows folks to, one, not feel so alone if they're blaming themselves for something like that happening, and two, it is the hard but the right thing to do, and it's a really healthy constant reminder that what we choose to do in those moments does, you know, change the narrative for our girls, our kids, and even like our boys. I can't remember. I don't have boys myself, but I'm trying to instill that same, like, you are in charge of your body. It is your body. You decide what happens or what does not happen to it. And you can be as vocal as you need to. And you also respect other people's wishes around their body. Like, even if they're, you know, my kids are 6 and 3, like, even if they're playing with their girlfriends but I read somewhere, I wish I could credit the person, but I'll have to look back, but about this, you know, this parent who had a son and was playing with a little girl, and she had said, stop. and he did not shame, and he did not make the little boy feel bad, but it was this beautiful teaching moment of no is no, no matter what the reason. It's just, we need to stop and we need to change. So let's learn. Like, how can we do this differently next time? And it was just such a beautiful example of how I think we can change the future trajectory and safety for all of our kids, boys, girls, children of all, you know, all gender. Yeah. So thank you so much for sharing that. And gosh, I have not in the way you have shared experienced that. And I can still relate to the feeling of knowing in a moment what's right to do and not necessarily having it be my action. So it's a really good reminder.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of professions where the ability to make other people feel confident and comfortable around you is a superpower. And you can have that superpower, but also learning your lines and learning how to be really confident, making other people uncomfortable. I think that's important. And to take it out of the sexual assault arena, as I moved from a revenue leader into a CEO role,
yep,
I'd say that this is also something that I've had to unlearn for completely different reasons.
Yeah.
Spent my entire career being really good at consensus building and driving alignment and selling my vision and getting people to influence, even when I had authority, but influence without authority, building a followership. And those skills are still really important in the CEO role. But at the end of the day, you cannot wait to build consensus to make decisions. And if you know that, what you know is that you're going to make decisions that make people upset, or they disagree, yep, or angry. And if I'm living in a world where I have to make everybody feel comfortable to move forward, I'm going to fail at my job. So that's a whole nother dynamic that I'm learning in this role of, you're doing something right. Like, the rightness of your decisions is not measured by the comfort of the people around you. Oh. And you can still vision pass and build followership when people disagree with you, as long as you're doing
it. Yeah, in a respectful way. How did you get comfortable doing that? Because I think of one of the things I think that about as I move from, you know, a line manager to a second line manager to an executive, I think one of the things that really shifted for me in starting to make me comfortable with some of that is actually saying it out loud. Like, I hate having to get people upset about stuff, but it's actually my job, yeah, to make a decision that I believe is the right one. And here's how I made the decision, or here's, you know, the why behind it. Like, those are some of the things that I've done to get more comfortable in that space, which I'm definitely still working on. What did that look like for you? How did you make that shift?
Tactics? I didn't. I'm still wildly uncomfortable doing it. And I think one thing that often holds women back, I see this especially at the director to VP transition, is they wait for confidence and comfort to feel capable. And I don't know that I'll ever, who I am as a person, I don't know that I'll ever feel comfortable doing what I describe. But the framework that I use is, what is my degree of conviction and what is my degree of confidence? And if both of those things are high, then I do the hard thing and I move forward with a decision, knowing that it might upset people. I do it before people have a chance to make their case. I do it when people have made their case, when a board member has said, this is the dumbest decision you could possibly make. If I have a high degree of confidence and a high degree of conviction, I move forward anyways. And what I know is, to get a high degree of conviction, I need to be really convinced that the path that this decision takes me down is the right path. And to get a high degree of confidence, I need to feel like I have asked all the questions and done all the things to de-risk my path from where I am to where I'm going. And so if I have those two things, it's worth being uncomfortable. And talk to me in 10 years. Maybe I'll say I've gotten better at it. But if anything, the advice I'd give, especially to women, is don't wait until you're confident. You're capable today. Say the thing, even if your voice shakes when you say it.
Oh my goodness. You took a big vulnerable, awesome leap lately, or recently. I would love to touch on, it's a little bit of a hard pivot, but would love to touch on, you know, your career journey and kind of how, whether it was very organic or it was very, you know, hey, this is my direction. I just need to find my pathway there, because you went from early on consulting to revenue leadership for a good chunk of your career to leaving what you've known and taking over. Not that what you've known, I'm sure so much of that is going to apply into what you're doing now, but into a CEO role. So what was that like for you, and how'd you find that path?
Yeah. Well, I talk a lot about how for the majority of my career, I thought I was going to go to law school and eventually be a judge high school. I never wanted to be a lawyer. I always wanted to be a Supreme Court justice, which maybe is an indicator of how my dreams get formulated. But I had to work full time in college. And so when I graduated from undergraduate, I was exhausted. And I was working full time and taking 20 hours of classes a week. And so my plan was to work for a couple of years, save up money so that I could, when I went to law school, I could just go to law school and just do one thing at a time. Found myself in business and kept getting promoted, really liked it, kept making jumps. And it was always in the back of my head that I was going to go be a Supreme Court justice, until fairly recently, I would say, where I woke up and I thought, this is not my path. And so I started saying, I want to be a CEO. And I don't think I understood what it meant, but what I knew was I have an ego, and I wanted to feed that ego with the title and the role. And I also am bossy, and I wanted to be in charge, and I wanted to get all the glory that comes with that, but I also wanted to take all the risk and discomfort. I wanted to be the one to make the big decisions. I wanted to be the one to do the scary thing. And I say that not really understanding the job, but I just kept saying it and saying it. And then I would say, if I'm honest, probably in 2021, in my soul, I knew I was ready, but I was the advice that I gave of don't wait until you're confident, I was struggling with that myself. So I thought I got to do a couple more things before I'm ready. And you would hear me say things like, my resume isn't there yet. And then at the end of 2023, I was working for a company where the founders were lovely people, smart. I believed in the business, but I also kept having this nagging feeling of, why am I doing this for them? I could go do this. If they can do it, I can do it. Big decisions would come up and they'd say things like, don't worry, we're going to take accountability for the decision. And they were trying to be nice, but it was like, I don't want you to, don't fall on a bomb for me. Like, I'm ready to hold the bomb and take all that comes with it. And so I called it my Deborah is Brave Day. I just decided I was going to put it out there that I had put some feelers out for a new chief revenue officer role. And I said to myself, that's not what I want. I don't want to do this for someone else. And so I sent an email and text message and reached out to everyone that I know. And I said, you know what? My next job is chief executive officer. If you come across an opportunity, or if you can help me network my way in, that's what I'm looking for. And was terrified that behind my back, people would say things like, who does she think she is? She's not ready for this job. And I was unbelievably delighted. Not a single person, to my knowledge, not a single person said that. And almost every person I reached out to responded with, I'm going to make this connection. I actually was just contacted about this opportunity. Let me put your name in the ring for it. And so that's what got me here. And now I'm here, and it is crazy. I say, if I could swear on your podcast, it's a shit show, shit show. So
okay. Oh, it's filling your cup.
It's filling my cup.
Taking the leap. That's great. How, throughout your, well, what have you found most challenging so far before I shift a little bit? Because that's a big, an amazing leap. And in your gut, since in the last few years, you knew you were ready. And so it seems like you've been mentally getting yourself like even more ready. Like, what have you found has been the struggle?
Yeah.
Over the first few, it's been a few weeks or a few, I think you announced it a month ago.
Yeah. It's been a little bit longer.
Okay.
But enough time to be able to answer that question, which I've definitely had moments where my confidence has waned in my career, but I can honestly say up until this point, I've never had imposter syndrome. And maybe this is an inflated sense of self, but I've always believed that I could figure it out. This is the first time in my career I've had imposter syndrome, but it's probably not what you and your listeners are thinking. It's not over the big decisions. It's not over the scary elements. It's not over the strategy. It's the minutiae. So I got a letter from the state of Illinois about something related to employment. It was half a page. And I sat there for 15 minutes reading it over and over again, thinking, what am I supposed to do with this? Qualified to get this letter. And then we hosted an event last night. And the night before, I was in complete imposter syndrome mode because I've never made, fireworks.
Oh.
Thank you, Apple. I've never made name tags before. And so I'm sitting there trying to figure out how do I get name tags together? And that the day-to-day minutiae in functions that I've never worked in, it gets overwhelming. So that has been really challenging. And I've had to tell myself like one bite at a time, people with way less experience navigate this. You can do this. You can make a name tag. You got this, girl.
You've got to have that internal cheerleader, that one that's on this side saying just once. I had a great, one step at a time. I had a great, leader that I worked for, and you would never, like, I would watch him work and think, oh my gosh, he's the most efficient, smartest, like, he's got it all under control. And I remember stepping into a brand new role. I had shifted from revenue on the new business side to customer success on the renewal and expansion side for the first time ever a few years ago. And I thought this learning curve is overwhelming, and the team was in a like really tough spot in a lot of different ways. And it was just like, the overwhelm was insane. Not on the minutiae, on like the day-to-day job though. And I remember him saying to me, there are days where all I have to say to myself, what is the first next thing I need to get done, and focus only on that and just do it. Mm-hmm. And like the name tags, it's like, I got to get the name tags done and the events tonight. So I'm going to sit down and do the name tags.
Right.
And that always stays with me when I'm like any kind of overwhelmed, whether it's a silly task or like I have to build a board deck that I'm nervous about building, you know. I'm like, okay, what is the next thing I need to do? And let's just sit here and knock it out. And that was always your story about it reminded me. It's like, just do it one step at a time. You'll figure it out.
It's how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time?
Yes.
Also, I've had to get really comfortable with failure. Yeah, I'd say failure. So I've had an impossible standard for myself my whole career. Not only have I not been able to fail, but everything has to be perfect at all times. And there is just too much, and I do not have the functional skill set for that to be the case. So I took the letter from the state of Illinois. I ran it by an HR partner, and they said, I don't think you have to do anything with this. And instead of triple checking to make sure that's the case, I filed it away. And the name tags, actually the name tags were beautiful, but I had some help there. But there will be a million decisions and failures in this role.
Yeah.
And balls will drop.
Yep. They sure will.
Great.
Yeah. It means you have time to catch the really important ones.
Yeah. We'll get through it.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Oh, that's good. That's really good. And what's been the best
What's been the best so far? I mean, I imagine it's getting to make the big decisions and taking the accountability, but like anything that was surprising in terms of the good and the parts you've really enjoyed?
I think, so I'm building out my team right now. I have a VP of engineering and a VP of customer success, and being able to not just hire them and pick the people I want on my team, but set the tone for how we work within the company. Okay. I've always had other people's core values that I've had to operate within. It's been really nice. And so brevity is not my strength. I'm a verbal processor, and transparency is both my biggest strength and my biggest weakness. And so what I like to do when I'm working through problems is talk it through, and talk it through before it's polished. And so I say, in collaboration sessions, I'll say a lot like, what's coming up for me right now is this, or I'm feeling insecure about this, but I can't quite put my finger on it. And I think it might be this. No, that doesn't feel right. And being able to do that is important, but also crafting a team where that type of collaboration is not only accepted, but is a positive. That's been really great. And I'm excited to turn that into, you know, $1 million at first, a $1 billion business with a million people who are drawn to what I'm describing, as opposed to me reinforcing the values that I would never join a company where I don't agree with their values, but they aren't mine.
Yeah. Oh, so good. So good. I'm excited to watch your journey. It seems like you're building something that's one from a product standpoint special, but then from a culture and people and place where you can really show up and contribute in a meaningful way. It seems like you're building that. So excited to cheer you on along the way. I know we're getting, we have some time left, but I know we're getting close. I am curious, your kids are a little bit older than mine. And we have people that listen from, you know, don't have kids and not sure they want them or don't want them, to empty nesters where they're done with like the kind, not done with parenting, but done with the most labor intensive part. I am curious how your kids are engaging with your work at this age.
This is actually a perfect question for today. So we are going through a branding exercise with my current company. We've got our new name locked in, and now we're in the concept design phase. So I have been getting colors and fonts and logo examples that I've been reviewing and giving feedback on. And my littlest loves seeing what they pull together. And so yesterday morning, she comes in to my bed in the morning, and I'm showing her the concepts. And I just gave her access to a Canva Pro subscription, which she loves. And so she left and she's like, I'm going to make you a logo. Didn't think anything about it. I had an event last night, so I got home at 9:30, and my husband is there. And he said, your daughter spent 4 hours tonight working on your logo. And I was like, show me. And he's like, nope, she's got to show it to herself. So it's 6:30 in the morning, little footsteps come running into my bed, and she brings her little Chromebook from school, opens it up, and she had made 7 different logos that she wanted to pitch. And I told her which one was my favorite. And we took a picture of her holding the computer with the logo. And then I took a picture of the logo and I sent it through to our brand team. And I'm told by her teacher that her show and tell this morning, her story was that she got to show her brand to a real marketing team.
Oh my gosh.
So it's so cute. So they're very.
Is that the most precious?
They, my oldest is not a creative, and so that's not her love language. She is more into, she actually, in like a weird way, I had to do a layoff one day over COVID, and she knew not to go to mommy's office, and she knew, you know, why mommy was upset at the end of the day. And so she'll often bring that up with her friends that like, my mom is a boss, but she got really sad when she had to fire people. And so like, she's leaning into more of the human element and can see the hard. And so they're very involved and in tune. And, Yeah, it's great. They both, neither of them want to be in business. They both want to be, one wants to be a kindergarten teacher, one wants to be a ninja. So, but they're loving watching me and they're very supportive.
That's amazing. That's really, really cool to hear. It's just interesting to kind of imagine, listen to stories of how it evolves. Cause I only have, you know, you only have the experience you have up until this point. So, that's amazing to hear. I guess before I shift into that one, I'd love for you to share something, anything to get us excited about what's coming from your business.
Yeah. So we're still in stealth mode, but we're actually pretty far along. We have a beta product. We have a design partner program, which is paid and companies pay to get early access and help shape the roadmap. And our product is enterprise software with a generative AI component that helps businesses write pre-sales collateral like proposals or SOWs in under an hour. So it's really designed for those businesses where they tell us they have teams of people and it still takes them days, if not weeks, to get this initial document together. From I'm staring at a blank sheet of paper to I'm through with the collaboration phase of document generation, it is 60 minutes. And so we have that proof of concept and beta going. We have our design partners well on our way. We expect to have a private preview in Q3. So invite only sales opportunity for folks that are interested in buying. And hopefully we will be out of stealth mode and ready for public consumption late this year or early 2025. But if there's any listeners out there that they are thinking 60 minutes to write those things, yeah, I'm in. Give me a call. I'm happy to talk anytime.
Well, coming from, it's a really neat transition from leading revenue organizations into this, because services for enterprise is such a huge component. Yeah. And I mean, coming from someone who's led new business sales, customer success, and also have been ahead of customer at the customer organization, that's not only life changing for the people in those roles that are turning a scoping call into an actual proposal, but then the customer experience when you can turn it around that fast and the revenue you can get by doing it, you know, that's pretty epic.
Yeah.
So excited to hear, and we'll definitely be sharing. And for those that may be interested, get in that design partner or private preview.
When I was in, I spent around 15 years in consulting and market research, and I would write these things with a partner and it would take us over a week to get them together. And the amount of time it took us to write the solution outnumbered the number of hours it took for me to surface the pain point, draft the solution, conceptualize how we were going to solve the problem. And the real neck up work, the human component, is getting somebody who comes to you with a problem they can't even articulate to a simple need statement. That requires just a ton of work as a human being to a human being, and then figuring out how you're going to solve it in a way that has nothing that they don't need but everything that they need. That's the hard work. But then we spend all of our time writing the thing. And so I had a heart pull to this business that if I can unlock the people who are tasked with writing these documents to focus on discovery, the customer, the solution, because the writing is no longer 15 hours of work, the impact that I can make on both sides of that equation is huge. That was my heart pull to this business. And I'm, you know, we're, gosh, 7 months in at this point, and we're already able to get kind of the start of that document generated and a huge head start for our users. It's really rewarding. I'm excited about the space.
Congratulations. Yes.
Thank you.
That's great. Before we wrap, I would love to, well, first of all, actually one more thing. Can you tell anyone that's listening that is interested how to find you and where to get more information before pre-stealth, post-stealth, you probably have to wait until you're post-stealth, but where can people find more? Find out more.
The best way to reach me is on LinkedIn right now. So Deborah Senra on LinkedIn, and send me messages. I'm really good at responding, especially to those folks that share this pain point. So that's the best way to reach me. In the coming days, we will have our new brand live and just a registration page if you're interested in the early adopter private preview program. So I'll be posting that all over LinkedIn, but LinkedIn is the constant. You can find me there.
LinkedIn. Okay, great. We'll make sure to have your LinkedIn profile and when that registration is live, that too in the show notes so that, and in the post so that people can find you easily. When you look back, I mean, we've covered a lot in this, you know, hour or so conversation. When you think back about a low in your life, because everyone's got them, even if they don't share them, which you were so gracious to share some of yours. What would you tell yourself now? Like, is there something that you look back to your, you know, your child self or your young professional, young mom, you know, and what would you say that you think she would need to hear?
Oh, at the risk of this sounding pessimistic, what I would say is there's nothing you can do to make your journey easy. It's going to be hard. It's where we are. It's going to feel unfair. You're going to want to scream into the nothingness time after time after time. But you will get to a point where you have the opportunity to make it better for those coming up behind you. And that makes it worth it. And every pain that you've experienced makes you that much more qualified to fix the most painful pieces of the journey for someone else. And so just keep going. Oh, makes me
beautifully,
teary.
Beautifully said. And I have goosebumps. I have goosebumps. That will be a quote that comes out and sticks with me from this conversation. One of many. I am so grateful that you not only spent the time with us, but you shared in a really honest, thoughtful. And while I don't think of that as pessimistic, I think of that as this is reality. And you can look at your real in many different ways, but if you look at your real and know in your heart that it is meant to teach you something and make you stronger over time, that's beautiful. That's optimistic. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
So thank you so much.
Thank you.
I love this talk. Yes, absolutely.
And that's a wrap on this one. Thank you so much for being here and spending your time with us. I know how busy you are. And that it was a choice to click on the Balance is Bullshit podcast and spend some time with us. So I really, really appreciate that. If you enjoyed the conversation today and got value out of it, there's so much you can do to not only support us, but potentially add value to someone else. Shout from the rooftops what you loved. Give us a rating or a review. Like us, follow us, subscribe wherever you're listening to podcasts. And don't forget to share this episode with someone that you think would love it too. We'll see you again soon.